We've covered over 100 true crime tales in the last 2 years, and the list of cases that need updates has grown. Does who have been identified, a conviction that was thrown out, information we were previously forbidden from revealing has been unsealed, and more. So tonight we're going to give quick recaps and then discuss the updates. Welcome to Insight. I'm Charlie, and with me today, as always, is Allie. How are you, Allie?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm good. We're ready for summer vacation with the kids, which is always a hectic time.
It's come around very quickly.
It has, and now I have to try to balance having all the kids at home and getting work done. So, you know, fingers crossed. Tonight is an update episode, as I said at the top, so it is going to be full of spoilers if you've not heard these episodes. So when I upload the file in the description in your podcast app, or if you listen on the website, open up that description. I'm going to put in timestamps for each case, and this will let you just skip over any updates on episodes that you haven't listened to yet. And we'll just go ahead and get started with an update to our very first episode. The first case we covered on the show was that of Lori Erica Ruff. Lori was a distraught woman. She was going through a divorce when she committed suicide in 2010. It was Christmas Eve, and her daughter was with her estranged husband at his parents' home. Lori drove to the home, and while in her car, in the driveway, she shot herself. Lori left behind two suicide notes. One was to her husband, and the other was to her daughter, with instructions for them not to open it until their daughter was 18. Her husband did open it, though, and the contents of both notes have not been made public, except to say it was a lot of rambling, and they were largely incoherent.
Lori had been secretive about her past, and her husband never pushed her. But when he was cleaning the house after her death, he came across a lockbox that showed that she had birth certificates and IDs in another name. The woman he knew as Lori had used the birth certificate of a deceased child named Becky Sue Turner in order to get an ID. She then turned around and used that to change her name to Lori Erica Kennedy, and she would then take her husband's surname Ruff when she got married. At the time we recorded, Lori's true identity was either just about to be discovered or had been but hadn't been officially announced yet. But it was announced in September 2016. Lori Erica Ruff's original identity was discovered through the work of forensic genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick and John Velling, who was a former Social Security investigator who had originally been on the case. Knowing that Lori had a daughter, Fitzpatrick was able to use a saliva sample from her to send to Ancestry.com's DNA analysis service, as well as 23andMe. While they found some distant cousins, it would be a few years before they found the right track that would lead Velling to the door of a Pennsylvania woman, and he had a photograph of Lori. Soon as this woman saw the photograph, she said, "My God, that's Kimberly."
Fitzpatrick only knew that she had the right family tree. She didn't know which person Lori was on this family tree. So it was quite the moment for Velling to show up on a doorstep with a picture and basically say, "I have no idea who this person is, but you might." A DNA test with Lori's mother would confirm her identity as Kimberly McLean. Kimberly McLean was born October 16th, 1968, in the Philadelphia area. As a teenager, her parents divorced and her mother remarried. And according to an uncle, Kimberly had difficulty adjusting to all of this change, a new house, new school, new rules. In 1986, at the age of 18, she moved to King of Prussia, which is about half an hour away from her mother. At some point after moving out, she told her mother she wanted no further contact, and for 30 years, her mother respected that. While this answers the question of who she was and why she was never reported missing, some are still unsatisfied by the answer that she walked away just because she had trouble coping with a divorce. Perhaps there is more to the story, but it does make sense why Lori unraveled so quickly as she and her husband headed to divorce themselves, if that was a major trauma in her life. The theories that she was older than she claimed also turned out to be false. There was only a 1-year difference between her actual age and the age she claimed. And the theories of her being a foster child who ran away, which was my preferred theory, or someone who aged out of the foster care system, or an escaped cult member, those all turned out to be false.
I remember at the time we recorded that we did go through all those theories, and I think we knew it was likely to be a more mundane one than she had run away from a sex cult. But I'm glad for her daughter and family that they can be connected, that her daughter can still have a family outside her father's family, I guess. But it is bizarre. I want to know more, which I know we possibly never will. It's hard to be so invested in a story to have an end with some answers, but not as many as you would like.
This was the first case we covered, and what we did when we first started the show is there were three of us, so we each picked one case to start with, and we wrote them. And so this was the first mystery I picked because it was that case for me, the one that I was so invested in. I'm glad her mother has answers and her daughter has answers and that they can connect. I think that's really important for them. But yeah, I mean, I'd like to know more about what was going on, but that's really, you know, also not my business. So I have to respect that.
The next update is for the case of the Beaumont children, which was my pet case. And we covered this episode as our second episode. Just a recap, on Australia Day 1966, Jane, Anna and Grant Beaumont went to spend some time at the beach at Glenelg. They were 9, 7 and 4 respectively, and they never returned home. Witnesses saw the children in the company of a man with blonde hair while at the beach, but this man was never identified. There are numerous theories, and it seems there is always someone coming forward with the belief that they know who the culprit was. We have decided to redo this episode entirely later this year. More information has come out, and we've learnt a lot about podcasting in that time, which is probably an understatement. And the case deserves our attention again, so we won't go too deep into everything, except to give the most recent development. In January 2018, 52 years after they went missing, police began excavating a site at an old factory. And this is the same factory that was searched in 2013, but they were looking at a different and larger section this time. They did not find the children's remains, but the basis of this search is the factory was owned by a man named Harry Phelps. Two men came forward saying that he had them dig a trench at the factory around the time the children went missing, and his son claims that he saw the children in the family's backyard. Phelps has not been named an official suspect, and that's in spite of police putting all that resources into searching his factory grounds twice.
I really do think it's interesting that they went back to this factory. I have to think that maybe these men who came forward had some pretty convincing information, because it's quite an expense to do a big excavation like this over a period of several days. That would have been a big expense, so you would think they had some pretty solid information.
You would think so. And I so want this case to be solved for the children's parents and for the general public who have followed this case for 52 years. I know that whenever someone asks in the Insight group or any other podcast group, which case do you want solved the most? And for me, it's this one. I think that's why I want us to redo it now. We know, or kind of know, what we're doing. But I really don't think this case will be solved, even if they do find the remains. I think too much time has passed, unfortunately.
We covered the baffling case of Zach and Greg Whitman on our fifth episode. After 13-year-old Greg had returned home from school on October 2nd, 1998. He was attacked. He was brutally stabbed in the entryway and fought his way down the hallway back into a laundry room where he eventually died. His brother, 15-year-old Zach, had been home sick from school that day and called 911 saying he had heard a noise, went downstairs and found his brother. Evidence from the crime, including a bloody knife that is believed to have belonged to Zach and a sports glove from the home, was found buried in the backyard. Zach was arrested for the murder and his parents supported his innocence. Even after his conviction, Zach insisted on his innocence and his parents sat for interviews proclaiming Zach's innocence. Then in February of 2018, Zach did a 180 and confessed to having killed his brother in a new plea deal. Now we have to back up and explain how someone who has been in prison for nearly 20 years was able to make a plea deal after a conviction. Zach had to be resentenced. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that juvenile offenders, even those tried as adults, could not be given an automatic life without parole sentence. Thousands of cases are under review due to this ruling.
In the process of figuring out the new sentence, Zach's current attorney found a plea offer given to him back when he was initially tried for the crime. Except Zach's trial attorney never presented the deal offer to him. That was a clear-cut case of effective assistance of counsel in the eyes of the judge, who vacated both the murder conviction and the sentence. Two options were placed on the table, either go back to trial or accept the plea. Zach accepted the plea, and it was essentially the same plea deal he had been offered in the first place. Zach admitted to stabbing Greg. He said that he hung up on Greg's girlfriend after school and Greg was angry. Zach tried to walk away from Greg, but Greg followed him, still angry. Zach put on the gloves and grabbed a knife to scare Greg. When Greg followed him downstairs, still yelling at him, Zach stabbed him. Greg ran through the dining room and into the laundry room where Zach continued stabbing him. The full sequence of events after that, the one a lot of us had questions about, like how much blood Zach did or did not have on him, and if he could have cleaned up in the tight time frame, these have not been revealed, but authorities have said that Zach's story fits the timeline better than the one they had come up with on their own. Under the new plea deal, he will be eligible for parole January 2019. And it looks like he has a lot of support for parole. He has a spotless prison record, and it's not believed he's a risk to the community if he is released. At the plea hearing, the judge said he hopes the family can find some peace. And the boy's father said in an interview after that that peace is all he hopes because he knows he can never have happiness.
I have always, with the story, felt so much for the parents because I think, you know, being a parent, that's who I identify with in cases like this. And I just can't imagine what this back and forth has been like for them. As far as Zach's story and that it was an impulsive thing, I can kind of see that as a 15-year-old. But why did he put the gloves on? That just stands out to me as something that is what, you know, we call a forensic countermeasure, something to prevent leaving evidence. So that, I don't know if that really fits for me.
It kind of shows premeditation to me that he wanted to try to get away with it.
Right, that he tried to not leave his fingerprints on the weapon or whatever. But I'm glad he finally told the truth. And I do think that a crime that happens when you're 15, 20 years, that's a long time to be in prison. I am not a lock them up and throw away the key type for people who don't look like they're likely to reoffend. And I don't feel like he seems likely to reoffend.
Exactly. Look, I trust the system and that Zach has had a full psychiatric assessment to show he isn't a risk to the community. As you said, he was a child at the time and he has served a long sentence. His sentence was longer than he had been alive at the time of the crime. I think that if they are comfortable that he isn't going to reoffend, and I think he's shown that in prison, I can see no reason why not to give him a second chance.
Another court case that has been turned on its head is that of John Juca, which was our sixth case. John was convicted in the 2003 death of Mark Fisher. Mark was 19. He was on his very first unchaperoned trip to New York City with some friends. He ended up separated from those friends, as sometimes happens when you're bar hopping. He ended up hanging out with John Juca and some of his friends. There's a whole lot of back and forth with taxis and girls and who's going where, but regardless of all that, the group, including Mark, headed back to John's house. His mother and stepfather were not home, so it was a good place for, I don't know, kind of an after party. While at John's house, John had another friend named Antonio Russo, and he came over. John said when he went to sleep that night, he left Mark in the living room. Then at 6:30 that morning, the police were called to the scene of a shooting. Mark Fisher was found 3 blocks away from John's home. He had been shot to death. John and Antonio Russo were both arrested, tried, and convicted in the case. John's conviction was largely based on the testimony of witnesses. And they were witnesses of various circumstances or things John may or may not have said. None of the witnesses actually saw the murder. And there was also testimony of a jailhouse informant. Now, 3 of the 4 main witnesses have since recanted their testimony, including that jailhouse informant. And that's where we left things with the episode. Then in February 2018, John's appeal was granted. The court ruling was harsh towards the prosecution for withholding evidence and for allowing their witnesses to knowingly give false testimony. In the process of taking a new look at the case for possible retrial, detectives went to Antonio Russo in prison, and Russo did something somewhat unexpected. He confessed. He said, yes, he's the one who killed Mark. He claimed the gun was his, and he said the motive was robbery. And he didn't implicate John in the crime at all, and that's obviously significant, but even more so because the gun being John's was a big part of the state's case, and Russo's saying no. There are issues with Russo's new statement. This isn't perfect. He had the type of gun wrong. He had the number of shots wrong. It's been a few years since this crime, so it's possible he's just not remembering it correctly. But he didn't implicate John in the crime, and that's the important part here because that makes it unlikely he's going to be a useful witness for the prosecution at all. And yes, the prosecution, because this appears to be going to retrial. Even with the confessed murderer not implicating John, and 3 of the 4 main witnesses recanting, including saying that they were pressured to testify and they were given secret deals to testify, the state plans to retry this case.
Out of all the cases that we've done that have, we're going to talk about the updates today, I think this one stands out the most to me. I don't know if he's innocent or guilty, but I'm all about a fair trial, which I don't believe he got the first time around. It will be interesting to see what comes out in the trial. I'm glad it looks like he is getting one. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens.
This one is an update, like you said, that's really kind of stood out because he's getting this new trial, but we have no idea what the prosecution's going to do because so much of their case is just, it's gone and it disappeared since he's been in jail. And now the appellate judge ruling, I mean, that it was harsh. It poked a lot of holes for them. I don't know why they're going ahead with the retrial. But it, like you said, it'll be interesting to see what they actually have.
I mean, it could come out in the end of this trial that it makes the prosecution look like fools, unless they have some smoking gun that we don't know about.
That's true. They could come out looking worse than they do in the appellate document.
Our next 2 updates have to do with missing kid cases we've covered. These cases are always really hard for us because we've both had those heart-pounding moments where we've temporarily lost track of our kids in public when they're either behind a clothes rack or in a tunnel of a playground where we can't see them. These cases are the cases that really stick with us. The first missing child case we need to update is William Tyrrell, which was back in episode 9. This is about information we did have to leave out in the episode for legal reasons that we are now allowed to reveal. William was a 3-year-old little boy playing outside his grandmother's house in rural New South Wales in 2014 when he went missing. There are a number of persons of interest in the case, but the news about William has been dominated since August 2017 with news of his parents. A matter that was sealed and not allowed to be reported on was that William was a foster child. The grandmother's home that he went missing from was his foster grandmother. The court ruled that it was legitimate public interest to reveal this information, and the judge said the probability is that William is not alive.
This decision allowed the names of William's biological parents to be revealed, and it has put them and their legal troubles in the spotlight. Both parents have accusations and arrests pertaining to violence, including domestic violence. Before William went into care, the couple was ordered by the court to stay away from each other, but they were seen together with William, and a decision was made to take William into care. But before that could happen, William's parents hid with him for 3 months to prevent this from happening. But they were spotted and found, and William was, as we know, placed into this foster home. Because they had previously hid William, they have obviously been thoroughly investigated in this case, and there has not been any evidence at all that they were involved in his disappearance. We did know William's status as a foster child when we recorded, but we honored the court's gag order on the information.
And Bill Spedding, who was one of the persons of interest in William's disappearance, was charged with numerous historical sex offences after William's disappearance. For those who don't remember, Spedding was a maintenance repairman who was scheduled to visit William's grandmother's home on the day he went missing, but this visit was cancelled. These charges were based on information that investigators came across during their investigation into William's disappearance. These charges were delayed with a trial through the court system for some time. I think we did talk about these offences in the episode, but in March of 2018, Bill Spedding was acquitted of all charges. On May 18th of this year, he attended court suing the nationwide news media in Australia for defamation for what he states was ruining his reputation. We will update you on this update when more information becomes available.
I really feel that revealing the biological parents' identity hasn't really helped the case at all. And if anything, it's been a huge distraction. The second missing child case we're going to update is that of Mikkel Biggs, the topic of episode 14. Mikkel was 11 and she was playing outside in 1999 with her sister. The girls were playing outside and they heard the chimes of an ice cream truck. They were waiting by the corner with their quarters as the sun went down, but the ice cream truck never showed up. And Mikkel's sister, Kimber, got cold, so she ran home, which was just a few houses away, to grab a coat. When she came back, the bike Mikkel was riding and her quarters were on the ground, and Mikkel has never been seen again. A reenactment concluded that Mikkel disappeared in a 90-second window.
Obviously, we recommend listening to our episode on the case, but recently the Vanished podcast, which I feel we recommend pretty regularly here, Marissa recently interviewed Kimber about Mikkel's disappearance, so we recommend listening to that episode. In March of 2018, news broke that a $1 bill was found in Wisconsin. On the border of the bill was written, "My name is Mikkel Biggs, kidnapped from Mesa, Arizona. I'm alive." It's worth noting that the first name was spelled incorrectly. It was missing the last L-E. The bill was printed in 2009 when Mikkel would have been 22 years old, so she would have been at least that old writing that if it was her. For the record, her sister believes the bill is a hoax, mainly since Mikkel would have known how to spell her own name. Police are currently investigating.
I agree with Kimber that it's likely a hoax. I think it's terrible if it got the parents' hopes up or Kimber's up. The only good thing it did was get the case back in the news.
I agree with Kimber too. I think it was a sick hoax. It does make me sick that people do that to play with the emotions and hopes of the families and loved ones, but we continue to hear about this in cases. I wish there were stronger laws against this to dissuade people from doing that. The next case we'll talk about is the case of Dee Dee and Gypsy Blanchard, which really captured everyone's interest. There have been a number of media appearances by Gypsy and a documentary since our episode on the case, which was episode 22. In June of 2015, Dee Dee was found stabbed to death in her Missouri home, and her wheelchair-bound daughter Gypsy was nowhere to be found.
Police traced Gypsy to her online boyfriend's home in Wisconsin and arrested both of them for the murder of Dee Dee. It turned out that Gypsy was not disabled. She didn't have any of the long list of illnesses and diseases that Dee Dee claimed. There was a long-running financial scam that started when Gypsy was a small child. Dee Dee claimed Gypsy was 19 at this point, but she was actually 23. Gypsy has claimed in these interviews that she did believe that she had many of the diseases, and shortly before Dee Dee's death, she had begged her mom not to make her go through an upcoming medical procedure. The update here is just that Gypsy's boyfriend Nick has spoken to the media for the first time. He appeared on the news show 2020, claiming that Gypsy was the mastermind behind the whole thing, and that his role was more that of a hired hitman of sorts. He said she asked him to kill her mother, to be with her, and directed the entire thing start to finish. Meanwhile, Gypsy puts more of the blame on Nick. Now, Gypsy did take a plea deal, but Nick's case is continuing. He initially wanted a bench trial, then he changed his mind and went back to a jury trial. He recently tried to get a new public defender assigned to his case, but that was turned down. Because of this back and forth and numerous psychological examinations of Nick, the trial's been rescheduled a number of times, and currently it's set for November of 2018.
This is another trial that I'm waiting with great interest. It will be interesting to see what comes out during the trial and if it differs any to the story as we know it. I do somehow think it will.
When Gypsy took a plea deal and didn't go to trial, a lot of information wasn't given out that we were waiting to see, like medical records and things like that. So a lot of that was in the documentary, which I recommend because they worked with the family and with Gypsy to get her medical records and crime scene photos and things like that. But it'll be really interesting to hear Nicholas's side of what happened. Now, our 25th episode was one of my personal favorites that we have done. It was one of the lighter ones that we've done, but if you haven't listened to it, you really have to. It was called The Poison Pen Letters, and we talked about the Circleville letter writer, which we don't have any updates for you on. But we also talked about the Watcher House, which was an ongoing story when we covered it, and we do have updates for that.
In June 2014, the Broaddus family bought a beautiful home for $1.35 million. After buying it, they began receiving letters from someone calling themselves the Watcher. The letters were vaguely threatening about the family bringing in quote-unquote young blood to the house. The couple did have small children, so they were obviously disturbed by this. They contacted the people who sold them the house, John and Andrea Woods, and they said they did receive a weird letter prior to the sale of the house, but it wasn't threatening and they had just thrown it away. The Broaddus family opted to sue the Woods for withholding the information that a stalker was watching the house. The update to that is that the case was thrown out in October 2017 because there is no evidence the Woods had purposely withheld the information. They never claimed their letter was threatening, and since they threw it away, there is no evidence one way or the other. But the more interesting update is that after the Broaddus family could not find a buyer for the home and the city wouldn't let them demolish the house to build two smaller ones on the lot, they had a renter move in February 2017, and weeks later, a fourth letter was sent. Now, this letter has been described as being more sinister than the previous. There were more specific threats in this letter. The house was back on the market in October of 2017 for $1.1 million. Now, that's a $200,000 decrease from what the Broaddus's paid for it back in 2014. And that doesn't count the renovations they invested in anticipation of moving in. A quick real estate search shows it is currently off the market, having not been sold.
I'm really interested in why this house won't sell. Are people really that convinced that the Watcher is real? I mean, to me, I thought it just smacks so much of a hoax. But I don't know, maybe it would freak me out. I do have kids. Do I really want, you know, the kind of harassment? Maybe people think it's a hoax, but they don't want the harassment of the letters.
See, to me, they're just letters. It's not like anyone has actually come up and said anything or they've had any strange happenings at the house. From what we can tell, they're just letters. And when the Broadduses were living there, the letters weren't that bad. They were a bit strange and cryptic, but they weren't that bad. And for me, for these new owners, when they had the renters in, to suddenly get a letter, and not just any letter, but a more threatening letter, it's almost like they were trying to prove a point. And after the approval for the demolishing and redevelopment was denied, there is a lot to question here about the legitimacy of the letters.
And you even have to wonder if that more threatening one was from the same person who even sent the others. It could have just been someone who's like, oh, someone's living in the house now. I'm going to pull a prank.
Exactly. There was a lot of media attention. It could just been someone doing it for, like a copycat, doing it just for fun, for a laugh.
Yeah, we'll see if this house ever does sell. Another Doe case was solved through DNA this year, very much like the Lori Erica Ruff one. In episode 30, we talked about Lyle Stevic. In 2001, a young man was found in a hotel room in Amanda Park, Washington, having hanged himself in the closet. He checked in under the alias Lyle Stevic, which is a name from a Joyce Carol Oates novel. There were a number of clues left behind in his hotel room, which caught the attention of many online sleuths. The DNA Doe Project is a nonprofit that uses DNA testing and genealogy to identify John and Jane Doe's, and they took on Lyle's case. While the commercial DNA databases are private, like Ancestry and 23andMe, there are public ones where people put their information in the hopes that they'll find relatives. So using these databases and genealogical detective work, they found relatives in both New Mexico and Idaho. They eventually narrowed down the family tree to a man from California who would have been 25 in 2001. Lyle's family, much like in the Lori Erica Ruff case, they believed their son had just wanted to be left alone. This estrangement was painful for them, I'm sure. But we've said it before, adults are allowed to leave, so they never reported him missing. They have so far asked that his true identity remain private. They may change their mind in the future. They've expressed through an investigator that they are overwhelmed by the interest in helping Lyle regain his identity, but at this time, they are not revealing it.
This hits me like Lori Erica did, a case that I was so interested in for so long, and then it's solved. But not just solved, but without answers to so many questions, creating even more questions. Questions that we most likely will never get answers for. I am happy for his family, though, to have the answers that they were looking for.
I do wonder if at some point they might go ahead and reveal his identity after things calm down a little bit or when they realize that people more care than are critical. But, you know, there was criticism of Lori Erica Ruff's family after she was identified for not having looked for her in 30 years. So, you know, they may be avoiding some of that, but I'm glad they have their answer.
In our 44th episode, we covered two cases that many wondered if they were connected. Was a long-time missing girl the same as an adult Jane Doe that was found nearly 60 years later? In 1938, the West family was on a Mother's Day picnic with their three kids and two friends. Marjorie was the youngest child and just weeks away from her fifth birthday. Marjorie's mother was sitting in the car talking with her friend while her father, brother, and another friend went fishing. Marjorie was left with her 11-year-old sister picking wildflowers for a Mother's Day bouquet. Her sister went to the car to give the flowers to their mother, and when she returned to where they were picking flowers, Marjorie was gone. Assuming the child wandered off, the family initially searched the area. It was a common picnicking spot, but it was rather remote. When they couldn't find her, they went to the nearest town for help. A massive search of the area began, but Marjorie was never located. Fast forward to December 1996, it was nearly Christmas, and a woman was found on the grounds of a children's section of the Pleasant Valley Memorial Cemetery in Annandale, Virginia. She left two identical notes with $50 in each, and the note said, "Deceased by own hand, prefer no autopsy. Please order cremation with funds provided. Thank you, Jane Doe."
She left behind a number of items, and a lot of that information has been made public, which makes it, like with the Lyle case, just a popular one for online sleuths. And I'm not sure who put the idea out first. Someone was looking through missing persons reports and connected Marjorie and the Annandale Jane Doe. They had similar coloring, the red hair, blue eyes. They were roughly the same age. So was it possible that Marjorie had been kidnapped, survived into adulthood, and then committed suicide, becoming a well-known Jane Doe? Now, it would be, you know, unusual for her to have her life bookended with these two major mysteries. Months after our episode, NamUs, which is a national database for missing and unidentified people in the U.S., announced they had DNA on file for both Marjorie and the Annandale Jane Doe, and it was not a match. Marjorie remains missing, and the Annandale Jane Doe remains unidentified. There's a great new article we linked in our Facebook group a week or so, maybe longer. It's about Marjorie West, and it's by Karen Listener, and we recommend checking it out. It was a great article.
For those who haven't read it, we might just bump that post up so you can easily find it. I do think it's wonderful what these online communities do with bringing up different missing persons that could be the Does. Their work, their tireless work is amazing.
It is, and I really feel it's out of these kind of online groups that we do have projects like the DNA Doe Project, where people are working together, because we didn't cover the Buckskin Girl Doe case, but that's another one that they were able to identify her through that, which was just fantastic. And it's nice to see online sleuths working in very ethical ways, because a lot of times I feel on the show we're a little critical when people are acting what we feel is unethical in what they're choosing to judge or report or rumors they're willing to keep going. But in Lyle's and Annandale Jane Doe and a number of others, there has been just a lot of very ethical work being done. So, you know, it's always nice to be able to bring that out, because I feel like we usually see the ones that are not great. For our 1-year anniversary episode, we had it voted on by our listeners, just like we did a couple weeks ago for our 2-year anniversary. We had several options, but one of them was given the vast majority of the votes, so we know you guys are as interested in this case as we are, and that was the case of the Spreckles Mansion, where in 2011, 6-year-old Max Shacknai went over a second-story balcony and landed in the foyer below. The day after his fall, Max's father's girlfriend, Rebecca Zahau, picked up Adam Shaknai, who's Max's uncle, from the airport. He was coming to be with the family as Max was in intensive care following the fall. That night, Rebecca was alone in the house and Adam was staying in the guest house.
6:30 the next morning, Adam said he left the guest house to go to the main house. In the shared yard between the main house and the guest house, he found Rebecca hanging, nude, from the balcony. He cut her down and called 911. Max's condition worsened and he died 6 days after the fall. Max's death was ruled an accident and Rebecca's a suicide, but this is when the accusations began to fly. While Max's father said Rebecca had actually tried to save Max's life by giving him CPR following the fall, Max's mother believed Rebecca had something to do with it. In turn, Rebecca's family did not believe the ruling that her death was suicide and believed she was murdered. Initially, they named Max's mother, her twin sister, and Adam in that, but eventually all parties dropped their accusations against each other, except one. Rebecca's family pursued a wrongful death lawsuit against Adam, claiming he sexually assaulted and murdered Rebecca, then staged the suicide scene. In April 2018, a jury deliberated for one day, and in a 9-3 decision said that Adam Shaknai had battered Rebecca prior to her death and his action caused her death. They awarded Rebecca's mother $5 million in damages. The sheriff agreed to take another look at the case in light of the civil case. New evidence was not presented, but it was more the interpretation and analysis of the evidence that was different.
For a civil case, the burden of proof is a lot less than in a criminal case. So even if the case they brought to the civil court was really strong, that doesn't mean that Adam could then be charged, because it's, you know, in the civil case, it's more like, is it more likely than not? Whereas a reasonable doubt is our standard in a criminal case. I was surprised, actually. I did not think they were going to win this lawsuit. It'll be interesting to see what happens on appeal.
I mean, when we went through the case, I'm not surprised what happened here in the civil case. And I am happy for Rebecca's family to have it recognized what happened to her daughter. But I mean, is it really justice? I don't know. We'll have to see what happens.
Our last update is to the Patty Pruitt case from episode 70. It was the first case we covered when I came back from maternity leave, so I remember it really well. According to Patty, on a stormy night in 1984, a man broke into her home in the small town of Holden, Missouri. Four of her five children were home and sleeping. And this man who broke in killed her husband, Bill, and raped Patty at knife point. Investigators just flat out didn't believe Patty from the start, and she was arrested for Bill's murder. She was offered a plea deal pretty early on for second-degree murder. It would have been a sentence of 20 years with the possibility of parole after, like, six. Patty maintained her innocence, though, and she turned down the plea offer. She was found guilty at trial, and her sentence does not allow parole before 50 years. So she has been in prison this entire time. Now, the state of Missouri has a law that allows for convicted and incarcerated individuals to petition to have DNA testing done on evidence in their case. The problem in Patty's case is that her lawyers for many, many years have been told there was no evidence left in the case. It had all been destroyed. There was a flood, there was a fire, whatever. The evidence was gone. Then a new Oxygen Network TV show called Final Appeal decided to take a look at Patty's case. Now, they made a similar request to the state for the evidence, and shockingly, much of the physical evidence does still exist, and they were able to find it. The episode came out after our podcast, but obviously it had been in the works for quite some time. I definitely recommend watching it. It gives a lot of information. We covered a lot of what is in it, but what they have that we can't do in an audio podcast, obviously, are the visuals, the pictures of the crime scene, the pictures of Patty and the kids and Bill, and the interviews with opinions from different people. They also had a professional crime scene reconstruction done to test the medical examiner's testimony that no one could have stood over Patty and shot Bill without having also shot Patty. But they showed through this reconstruction, based on the trajectory and the position of Bill's body, that it was absolutely possible there was plenty of room.
Weeks after our episode went out, the Midwest Innocent Project filed on Patty's behalf for post-conviction DNA testing on a number of pieces of evidence that were found, because they believe these items will show the evidence there was a third person at the crime scene. The intruder, Patty has always said, was the real culprit. These items include Patty's pajamas that she was wearing that night, the telephones and cords in the house, three various knives, a towel that was found near the pond the gun had been found at, the pillow and pillowcases Bill was lying on when he was shot. The photograph of the pajama bottoms shows some kind of discoloration in the crotch area. Obviously, with that testing, we can't say what that discoloration or staining is. And as it stands now, that testing will not be done. The request was denied in May of 2018. The judge ruled that there isn't a reasonable chance that any evidence the DNA testing would provide would have changed the outcome of the trial. Even if a third person's DNA was found on those items, it wouldn't automatically mean Patty is innocent. It could be transfer or possibly contamination, or the person had an innocent reason for touching that towel. A large number of DNA exonerations are cases that involve a sexual assault, since the DNA sample is often from semen, and there are far fewer innocent explanations for semen to be on or in a victim's body. Without knowing what is actually on Patty's pajamas, I'm not sure how the judge can say that it won't make a difference. The law requires DNA evidence to conclusively show innocence, and the judge does not believe this burden can be met. Patty's attorneys are, of course, appealing the decision.
In reading what the judge said, he 100% believes Patty did it, and is basically said, well, she did it, her story doesn't make any sense, and whatever's on her clothes or the telephone, anything, none of that's going to change the fact that her story doesn't make sense. But even the most nonsensical stories, which I don't think Patty's story is that nonsensical, but let's say it was, even those can sometimes be true. We can't always explain everything. We don't know everything. I mean, until they test those pajama bottoms, if those are semen stains and they can match them to someone, we're getting closer to proving innocence.
As I said, I don't know how anyone can say that possible evidence won't make a difference without even knowing what that evidence is. I think there is a precedence being set here by not testing. It's not a good precedence, but one all the same. I really do hope that this appeal is taken on board. Patty is deserving of a fair trial.
And I think that's something a lot of people looking at her trial can agree to. It wasn't a fair trial. That ends our updates. I know a lot of our cases are ongoing. Some of them are really cold cases, but we have seen some ice cold cases get solved recently, like the Golden State Killer. So we may have some surprising updates in the next 100 episodes. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at Insight Podcast, Twitter at Insightful Pod, Instagram at Insight Pod, or email us at insightfulpod@gmail.com. You can also support the show at patreon.com/insightpod. And a special thank you to Chesgrave Music for our new custom theme.